Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Available on Apple Podcasts and Podcast One.
Hey, it's Todd. Before we get started, if you like what you hear or you have any questions about this podcast, please tweet at me at @Todd_Garner on Twitter. Look forward to hearing from you.
For nearly 30 years, Todd Garner has overseen blockbuster films like Con Air, Anger Management, Triple X, 13 Going on 30, and Black Hawk Down.
Why are they letting you make these movies?
Join Todd as he shares tips and stories from the front lines of producing in Hollywood.
I'm Adam Sandler.
I'm Rebel Wilson.
This is Jeff Probst.
I'm Kaylee Cuoco.
I'm Eli Roth.
This is Marlon Wayans.
Hey, it's Ed Helms.
This is Shay Mitchell.
Everybody, this is Kevin James, and this is The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide.
The Producer's Guide with Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
Todd Garner.
What a combination.
All right. I'm here with Bryn Mooser. Hello, Bryn. How are you, brother?
I'm great. Great to be talking with you.
Oh, man. I'm so psyched to be talking to you as well. I have been doing nothing but binging documentaries since I have been locked away in this pandemic. And you know, if you look at the ratings of Surviving R. Kelly and Tiger King, it feels like a lot of people are doing the same. So I wanted to speak to someone who is an expert in this subject because it's such a unique art form and such a unique opportunity for distribution right now with all the streamers and the fact that documentaries, for the most part, don't need theatrical runs to be successful. I mean, if you look at Fyre Festival and Last Dance, it just premiered on ESPN. It's just been an incredible time for documentaries, and you are right at the forefront of it with your company, XTR. I wanted to get into this with you about how you've been making movies, how it's affected you, and kind of where you see the way that documentaries are headed in terms of this new distribution model. But yeah. Before that, how did you get into documentaries? Because it seems like such a noble and specific route. It's always been a mystery to me how they get made. And the more that I see just the incredible storytelling and the entertainment value in them, the more I'm starting to realize there is a convergence of traditional filmmaking and documentary filmmaking that I never really understood before.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm so glad to be here, and it's a real honor to be talking with you. There's nothing I like more than talking about this moment in documentaries because I think it's kind of the most thrilling thing that's happening in media and entertainment. But, you know, just how I got into documentary. And I think this talks about the change in the industry because I came in a more traditional way. I started my career as an aid worker. I was in the Peace Corps in West Africa for 3 years. After that, I ended up in Haiti where I helped build a high school and a film school and a music school and started to make films around what I was seeing on the ground in Haiti. They were mostly like nonprofit videos. And one of the videos was about a movie theater that we were rebuilding after the earthquake. And it was like 30 minutes and it was longer than a nonprofit video. This is 2010. And my best friend at the time, David, who co-directed it with me, we thought, hey, you know, maybe we should send this to a film festival and see if it can get in. And the first film festival we sent, film festival we knew at the time was Tribeca Film Festival. And we sent it and we got in. And we had this moment where we thought, man, are we filmmakers? Like, is it that is it that easy to make a film? Like, is it, you know, because I think as him and I both grew up, I studied film in school. We both are, you know, huge film fans. And like the fact that we could take these, you know, kind of consumer prosumer cameras that we were using on the ground anyway, you know, these Canon 5Ds, and make something that looked, you know, as high a quality as could go to a film festival, I think was a real breakthrough for us where we thought, you know, the barrier of entry just got, the door just opened to us, right? And I mean, I think if you think back to when I was in film school, which was like, you know, 2000, 2001, if you wanted to make, or when you first started making films, if you wanted to make a film that looked like a blockbuster or could get nominated for an Oscar, it was really expensive. You know, right. You had to shoot it on 35 or 16. Like, you couldn't just take a camera that you buy on a corner store and make something that looks as good as anything else. And so I think this has just been kind of, you know, a bunch of technological breakthroughs on the distribution side, on the camera technology side, that has enabled this moment in documentary. But it is a truly revolutionary moment that's happening in documentaries, which to me just feels like it's almost as if this new entertainment vertical and business is really opening wide for the first time.
Do you remember the movies that really got you excited about becoming a filmmaker? Do you remember what those were growing up?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I remember when I was probably 14, I was living in Maine at the time, and my dad, we didn't have that much money, but my dad bought a new TV for the family that was like a 25-inch, you know, like boob tube, which seemed like cinematic. I'm sure you remember those TVs. It was so exciting when you could buy. It was 25 inches. And we went to the video store and he rented Apocalypse Now. And we watched Apocalypse Now on, you know, VHS on that TV. And my dad, it was his favorite movie, just described every scene as it was happening and why it was interesting and why it was important. And I remember there was the moment where like the tiger jumps out at you. And he was like, yeah. this is going to look immersive when this, you know, and then it happened. And so, yeah, I remember that, you know, I was growing up in New York City and my mom brought me to watch Do the Right Thing when I was really young. And so it was kind of like those type of movies that got me inspired. And then when I got to high school, you know, I hung out with the art kids and they all turned me on to Tarantino and Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction. And that kind of put me on that trajectory, I'd say.
And so we were boots on the ground in the Peace Corps, and you saw that you had these cameras that could actually, you know, give you the quality that you were looking for. How did you know how to tell a story? Did it unfold as you went? And most of the storytelling is told in editing. So how did you even know how to do all that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's interesting. It is so much of a documentary. Is in the edit, but it's also in the story that's there in the first place. Like, I think just to set the tables, in order to make a great documentary, you need two things. You need either access to a character who you can go on a journey with, or you need access to an archive. It's just those two things, right? Like, you either have a bunch of footage and you could tell the story, or you have somebody who's willing to tell their story. And I think that, you know, as somebody who was lucky enough to be in a place like West Africa or Haiti after the earthquake and working on big projects, you're seeing a wealth of extraordinary stories unfolding. You know, you just got to know when to turn the camera on and when to keep it rolling. You know, my partner, David Darg, who I built my first company Riot with, you know, he's probably one of the greatest documentary filmmakers I know. He is, became the director, you know, and it was the first film we made. We were co-directors because I wanted to be like, wear the beret and, you know, smoke a beady cigarette and be a director. But I realized very quickly that, like, I'm a producer and I'm not the director. And, you know, it is my job, it's our job to enable incredible directors and filmmakers to be able to be the best that they can be. And we have to make that happen, make that dream happen.
And so when you were starting out, where did you find those two things to start making documentaries? Because I think, if anybody who's listening to this is interested in that field, that seems like the most daunting part, is trying to figure out what character or what archive you want to spend the next couple of years of your life on.
Yeah, some of that we were lucky enough to just have unfold in front of us. You know, the first films we made were about Haiti because we were living there. One was about this building, this movie theater in a tent camp. The next film was about the cholera epidemic, and David and I were working in a cholera center at that time. So we kind of were filming everything that we saw around us.
Is that Baseball in the Time of Cholera?
Yeah, Baseball in the Time of Cholera. And then
that's
film
the one that won the jury award, right, for the Tribeca?
Yeah, we won the jury award with that film. And then the next film we made was about the Ebola crisis in Liberia. And, you know, we shot most of that on GoPros, Some of it on flip camera. And we were, you know, we took that film to HBO and we got nominated for our first Oscar with that film. But that was like, we were proud to be able to be nominated with that film because we shot it on GoPros and flip cams, right. You know, like, it was punky. And we were trying to make this point that I was talking about earlier, where this barrier of entry, it's been eroded, right? Like, in the past, if you wanted to make a film, you had to be like, the son of a famous movie executive, or so, like, you somehow had to get access. And same is true with the music industry. Like, how are you going to get into Capitol Records? Like, you need this kind of first amazing break. But now you've got everybody having, you know, an incredible camera on the back of their iPhone. This barrier, it doesn't exist anymore, right? So there's like almost these no excuses, excuses that got me in trouble in film school where I said, oh, I'd love to make that film, but I just can't afford a 35 millimeter camera. But if I had the camera, I'd make the best film ever. And now like you have, you know, young people have access to the camera technology so they can tell their own stories, which I think starts to give a new crop of filmmakers, which, you know, makes for a better industry when you have that diversity to start with.
And when you're picking your subjects and or your characters or your archives, what's your North Star in terms of you think, okay, this is a story worth telling? And in general, how much archival footage versus how much original footage do you generally start with?
I mean, I think that that's also part of what is changing so much. Like, I think about the docs that have inspired me so much in the last couple of years, like LA 92. You know, it's all archival, right? There's no talking heads on it. And I think that we're seeing more and more of that. Or you're seeing documentaries that are half narrative, half documentary. We supported an incredible documentary called Bloody Nose, Empty Pockets at Sundance this year that blurs this line between documentary and, you know, a narrative film. So I think that as these new voices come in, you're just going to see kind of an explosion around what the format is. You know, and I think that goes back to your point about the documentary as an art. You know, just to set, I think, the where we are right now in the industry, the thing that is certainly drives me to build XTR is that you have with documentary distribution for the first time ever, true distribution. You know, like you're talking about the streaming platforms. You know, if you wanted to see a documentary 10 years ago, 5 years ago, you have to go to an art house movie theater. It's playing for 1 week. Maybe there's a corner of the Blockbuster, you know, the Blockbuster movie store where they have documentaries, or your teacher wheels in a TV and a VCR to your classroom. Like, it just, you couldn't have access to it. And now you turn on Netflix and, you know, Tiger King is right next to The Extraction, right? And the, you know, the, right, that big Netflix movie that costs hundreds of millions of dollars. And turns out more people are watching Tiger King. And the same is true with the, you know, with The Last Dance, the Jordan documentary. You're just now having audiences, I believe, who have access to this type of film, to these type of films, and they are loving it, demanding more, wanting more. And that's where this is a kind of, I really believe, a revolutionary moment. You have to also remember that, like, this generation has grown up on reality TV and YouTube and doesn't look at the way that, you know, perhaps we think of documentary, which is, okay, this is nonfiction and fiction. They just look at it all as some mashup of this is TV, this is films, this is storytelling. Like, fiction and nonfiction is a blend for this generation. And I think as a filmmaker, you know, that just means you've got real distribution for the first time. You've got, you know, the camera technology allowing for new filmmakers to come up. And because you have the streaming wars, you have, you know, billions and billions of dollars going into premium content. And the growing piece of that pie is premium nonfiction, especially post-COVID.
Yeah. I mean, it's so fascinating because when I'm in the academy, and you're right, like 10 years ago, one of the biggest joys of getting all the screeners was we got all the documentaries and you could sit and watch all of them. And I was always so in love with them even back then, just to be able to see different worlds and different stories told from different filmmakers than the ones that I was accustomed to just, you know, being in the Hollywood ecosystem. So when even before you started XTR, you built another company and yeah. When you were building it, and somebody would bring you a story, kind of what was your measure whether you took it on or not?
You know, we were, a lot of the company's focus on Riot was, I was very interested in this idea that film stories, content would drive people to engage in actions to make the world a better place. I mean, I was building this from my tent in Haiti after the earthquake, where I was seeing that kids that were going to our high school in Haiti were some of the poorest kids in the world. They come from Cité Soleil, which is, you know, the biggest slum in the Western Hemisphere. They are very poor, but, you know, of course, very smart, but they all have access to a cell phone. They have a smartphone. They're on Twitter. They're on Facebook. They're connecting and sending me messages. And so as I sat and looked at that, I thought, you know, it was striking to see that the technology, social media, the internet, especially this is 2010, were connecting people of very different classes, not only geographical, but of classes. And I still felt like media was kind of this one-way flow of information. Like we talked about the newspaper boy throwing the newspaper over your fence, right? Like, but if we're all connected to each other, there's a way that you can use stories to inspire action. So when we built Riot at the time, it was a news site. It was a documentary company that the films were supposed to have these kind of action campaigns associated with them. And so at that point, we were looking for stories that were really, you know, to be inspired, to inspire people. You know, we made the film On Her Shoulders, which is on POV on PBS, shortlisted for the Oscar a couple years ago about Nadia Murad, who won the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, we think if you watch that movie, you kind of can't help but be inspired and want to do everything you can to help her and her people. So it's those kind of stories we were looking for. And I think now with XTR, those are still the heart and soul, but we're also telling, you know, big, hopefully blockbuster documentaries. And if, you know, you look at the industry, you've seen the biggest sales for documentaries in the last 3 years that you've ever had. And that, you know, we think that that's only going to increase. So while we still want to tell stories that are inspiring, I think we're also looking for stories that capture the imagination.
And how do you find those stories? Again, if you're somebody yeah. who's just a lay person to the industry and not even being such a huge, you know, muckety muck in the world as you are, but if you're just somebody who's really interested in it, and like you said, has access to this filmmaking technology with their smartphone yeah. and their laptop, et cetera, how do you go about finding those stories?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, I think that the thing that's powerful about documentaries is that there's no shortage of stories, right? Like from the big stories like, you know, Jordan, not everybody can make the Jordan docuseries. But, you know, I think about films that have inspired me in the last couple of years. I don't know if you remember Minding the Gap was nominated for the Oscar
sure.
years ago. What an amazing film, which is basically just a kid, Bing, who took all of his old skate videos and told the story of his friends growing up, you know, with this backdrop of relationships with your parents and abuse. And I mean, that film is, I think, a great example of the kind of story that, you know, it's unlikely that becomes one of the biggest documentaries of the year, and it's on Hulu. It's just a quiet story of somebody's friends and family, but that is the best documentary of that year. And I think it's a good example of just, you know, it's just somebody's personal story. And so I think that there's certainly like people want to tell the big stories of Amy Winehouse or, you know, Michael Jordan, but there's also just incredible stories that unfold around everyday heroes or relationships.
Yeah, I mean, it has been a theme on this podcast with all the filmmakers is really trying to find your own voice and trying to find stories that resonate with you and speak to you. And again, everybody has a world that they live in and a sphere of friends that know other friends. And you just if you just keep your eyes and ears open, you can actually see a lot of great storytelling and drama just in the world directly around you.
Totally. Totally.
And I'm so fascinated by, like I watch the Fyre Festival doc or Minding the Gap or Tiger King or these docs where they have so much footage that these people have been, you know, like it's one thing to have The Last Dance where it's like, all right, Phil Jackson's last year, Michael Jordan's probably going to leave. We should probably document this as they go for their sixth world title. But like the Fyre Festival doc and Tiger King, you can just see there are so many interesting stories that are out there right now that yes. are sitting out there with tons and tons of footage that somebody just decided, you know what? I'm so interesting that I'm going to document my every move. It's yeah. fascinating to me because I don't have that. And I guess more and more people are now with social media, as you're saying, documenting more and more of their lives. But to see that, see the level that these guys and gals went to document themselves has been fascinating. I mean, the Hillary doc is the same way. You just realize, wow, there's so much footage out yeah. there that can be mined and turned into something great if you just have some story instincts about you.
Well, we supported and co-financed this doc that was at Tribeca, or is it Tribeca? I don't even know how to say it anymore because Tribeca is happening, called Miracle Fishing. And it was about a guy who is kidnapped in Central America, and his family comes down to try to get him back and spends a year trying to get him out of from his kidnappers. And the kid is a filmmaker. He has a VHS camera. And at some point in the early part of when they come down, they say, hey, why don't you just start shooting everything? And he films the entire year on VHS of trying to get his dad out. And it is like, when you watch that, you'll love it. It's right up your alley. It's like an action film of them, you know, and they drop off money here and they go here. And it's like just, it twists and turns, but it is all shot on a, you know, VHS camera. And, you know, that's another example where they just had those tapes sitting in a drawer. And I'm sure they thought many times, you know, that would make a good film. You know, look, it's only now I really believe that a film like that will find an audience. So, you know, the Tiger King is incredible that they had all that footage. You know, it's kind of that movie had to come out now, you know, or that series had to come out now. It needed Netflix. It needed us to be in this moment, you know, where we're looking for escapism. Like, it was this perfect storm. And, you know, I would argue that like 5 years ago, Tiger King doesn't work.
Yeah. I mean, it's incredible that the world has really kind of risen to the level of acceptance that it is in terms of not just the form, but forgiving the, you know, if it's an iPhone, VHS, Super 8, whatever it is, just writing with it. In fact, a lot of times all of those different mediums really make the thing a lot more delicious and a lot more layered and interesting by seeing all the ways that the footage is. It's like a Spike Jonze movie.
Right.
Just whenever you're able to put all the scenes together. And what's fascinating is when it works, it works. And when it doesn't, it's painfully obvious. Like, the after show of Tiger King did not work for me, even though I thought technically it was great in terms of being able to use those iPad Pros and have it look relatively broadcast worthy, but just the form of it was so odd that it didn't work for me. Whereas I just rode with all of the crazy footage in the documentary just because it was so well put together.
I also thought that maybe it was a tangent, but I also thought the tone had changed between the after show and the show, which was we were on the journey. We weren't, you know, we weren't necessarily making fun of people to their, it just felt like the tone shifted, where it was something about Tiger King where you were, you know, you were definitely like your jaw was on the floor, but it wasn't mean spirited. And I think that's part of the documentary. You go, you want to be on a journey with these people, and whether they're likable or not, you're kind of with them the whole time.
Right.
But I think back to your point about like quality, I wonder what's going to happen in kind of this post COVID world where, you know, you're looking at American Idol or late shows or all of this other stuff being shot on iPhones or SNL. Like, you know, to me, it's still hard for me to wrap my head around it. You know, it doesn't look good, but I wonder if that's going to, you know, also be part of a sea change, that television doesn't have to look glossy anymore. I don't know. I think it's going to be really interesting to see.
I definitely think there's been a movement of having things not need to look glossy anymore. And I think, to your point, it does go back to the YouTubers and the Instagrammers and things like that. Is there's a whole generation that is just used to seeing stuff on a certain kind of quality. I mean, back, I'm old enough that the only time you would see that was like America's Funniest Videos, you know, but then you have you start to get into the MTV world, the real world, and Big Brother with security cameras and ridiculousness with all the iPhones and such, that there's an overwhelming push towards just storytelling over the look of it and the gloss of it. And I find it's interesting if it's strung together in a way that makes sense for the story you're telling. I find it a little more off-putting if it's used as a gimmick, you know, like, oh, this is a found footage movie, or if it's just cheaped out, like somebody's, you know, just trying to make a grab for, you know, eyeballs right now because people are stuck at home.
Right. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think it's the changes that are going to happen after this into entertainment are just going to be felt for a long time. And, you know, it either breaks towards the more interesting, or it breaks a lot of good things that are happening. But I mean, I just think that this is such an extraordinary moment where I'm an optimist about this moment. And so I'm a real, like, all is possible coming out of this. And I also feel like, you know, people talk about when do we go back to normal, but it's like normal was kind of the problem in the first place. And so to me, what's possible out of this is something different and something new. And part of that hopefully is a shakeup of the old power dynamics, you know, like the people who were in power for so long are not going to be in power after this in the entertainment industry. And so you have this real extraordinary moment, you know, if people can just hold on through, I think, what's going to be a challenging time, there is a really interesting outcome possible.
Well, let's talk about that, because I want to get into the distribution in general pre-COVID, and then I want to get into the sales and distribution, kind of what's happening post-COVID. Because pre-COVID, it seemed like a lot of these sold at festivals. That's where you would get kind of the most impact, because you want buyers to see their product being seen by an audience, even if it's a streamer, because at least you know that you have a reaction in the room. So, I mean, you guys were famous for going to Tribeca and Sundance and the various film festivals, and you have the David Arquette movie that was going to go doc movie that was going to go to South by Southwest. So before COVID, was that the primary way that you guys would sell distribution to your docs, or did you have other ways, like sending links, or because you had relationships? In general, what was the best way for somebody who, after they, you know, found their subject and, you know, told a great story, put it together with whatever filmmaking equipment they have, what was the best way to go get it sold pre-COVID?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I'll just kind of set it up too, like, the reason that I'm and have built XTR is that, like, in this incredible moment for documentaries, historically, doc studios, you asked the question, how do you get into documentaries? Like, doc studios have been almost like followed like a mom and pop type production company format, or almost like a nonprofit format of the way they were born, where you have a filmmaker who is dying to tell a story, makes a great doc, and then kind of can scale similar type projects after that, but maybe only does a couple films, you know, maybe a film every couple years or something. What there hasn't ever been is great studios like Neon or A24 or Miramax, Blumhouse, Pixar, for only documentaries. And really that was because, there wasn't a business, you couldn't build a big enough of a business to make that a reality. And so, you know, just kind of setting the stage, like, I started XTR because I feel like we are at the very beginning of this revolution in documentary. The business is going to just continue to grow even during COVID and after COVID. And I just think that there's an opportunity to build something different, a studio that has a brand that people love, that people can think about associating with a high quality documentary. So all of those pieces were kind of the ideas of the foundation of what we're trying to build. I raised money from investors, more like a startup, like I did with my last company as well. But it was also looking through the lens of, like, trying to figure out how you do things differently, including sales, right? So to answer your question, the best way previously to sell films was going to film festivals, right? You wanted to be the buzziest documentary at the film festival that people were talking about. More and more, you were actually seeing celebrities at the film festivals were associated with the documentaries. Like Sundance, all the big celebrities this year were documentary people, Taylor Swift, Hillary Clinton, Ron Howard directed a documentary, like Kerry Washington executive produced a film, The Fight, that we helped out on. So it was like documentaries were a really buzzy way to get a lot of attention. But we also now live in this very small community where, as you know, there's 30 people who make the buying decisions around documentary films. Those are 30 executives at the different streaming platforms or places. There's only 30. And those 30 people are friends of mine, close enough that we can send a text and say, hey, we're working on this project. What do you think? I think, especially where we're moving, that feels more like how it's going to go down. The personal relationships, connection to people to say, hey, are you interested in this? And that's either a, yeah, that fits, let's take a look, or no. And what I'm interested in doing is how do you cut out all the old school stuff, which is like it takes a month to get a meeting and you pitch and you do all this crazy pomp and circumstance just to get to a no. Like, can't we get to a place where you can get to a yes or a no over a text or a maybe? And a maybe is enough to just go hard and make the materials, et cetera. So I think there's a way to build it better than this kind of festival only strategy, which is just like you got to be the number one film at the festival. And in documentaries, Sundance is such a heavily weighted festival where it is the leading festival for documentaries. The number two is so far away that it's there's not even a competition for, you know, it's just like Sundance. If you're in Sundance, you're going to have an amazing year. If you're not, you got to really figure out a way to get your film sold. I think there's a way to build that better.
And so is XTR going to then, or is XTR now a traditional studio model where people can bring you ideas and you will help them develop them and help them find filmmakers and traditionally develop and go through production and then look for distribution? How is your model laid out?
Yeah, totally. We fully finance, we co-finance. I have an investment arm where we can put money as an equity stake in documentaries. We also have a nonprofit arm called the XTR Film Society that can give grants to filmmakers, non-recoupable grants, which is a lot of my background. And then we're developing. So we have a TV arm that's developing nonfiction TV and podcasts. And then we have our traditional kind of films. We look for distributors and studios at various stages of the project. You know, sometimes it's at the beginning, sometimes it's in the middle of production. Most likely it's at the end where we start making phone calls and saying, hey, is this something that could fit into your slate? So, we've got 22 documentaries right now that we're in production on. We are proud that we've been able to stay in production on all of those, which I think is a testament to documentaries in this moment as well. I think that we'll continue to stay really busy during this time.
That's amazing. And so your theory then, which is getting to be more and more true in traditional content, is you actually are taking them all the way through completion so that you can show completed films and television series so that you'll have the best opportunity to make the best deal because it's completed. Is that true, or are you trying to get distribution even before you've completed the doc?
I think it depends on the project, right? Like, there are some projects that you can walk in the door of a distributor in an early phase and they go, yeah, we'll co-finance this with you or they'll fully finance it. So we definitely are packaging projects and taking them before a frame is shot. But if there are films that we think are hits, then we will finance them ourselves, or we'll go to investors to finance ourselves. And then it's our job to make the best documentary we can, and then we'll try to sell it in the marketplace. I think that's, you're going to see more of that probably, as kind of things change. But right now there's a lot of places that are, buying, and there's a lot of places to sell nonfiction to. I think it's exciting for me when I think about all of the places that buy a documentary, like not only all the traditional broadcasts, but then all the streaming platforms. Like, you can sell a doc to MTV or CNN or CNBC or Netflix or Hulu. It's harder to sell an indie film. You know, you're not going to sell an indie film to CNN. And so I just feel like there's a lot of places where you can take these films. And again, there's no shortage of great films and films that need help. The universal thing I would say for documentaries across the industry is all of them could use more money. So right. If you've got access to resources, then you can find a lot of great projects. And I think as I thought about building a studio and looked at the landscape, it was clear that there wasn't a shortage of great films. There is a shortage of the right kind of money to invest in those films. Right. And raising money is an easier problem for me to solve than finding projects that don't exist, right? It's much much better to think about how you just find the right kind of financing for projects.
Right. So let's talk about the deal making part of it, because on Netflix, Tiger King sold to them before it aired, and I'm 98% sure that they don't have a deal that has any more teeth to it, pardon the pun, the more eyeballs that are on it. It's a flat rate. So when you're selling your documentaries and you're looking at traditional networks or streamers, what is the type of deals that can get made for documentaries?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that each film is different. You know, some filmmakers just want their film to be seen by as many people as possible. And so as we think about a strategy like that, that determines where we favor or what places we favor. Some people want the most money. And so if people are like, I just want a lot of money for this, I don't care where it ends up, then we also think about who's buying and who's spending that kind of money. But ultimately, I think every filmmaker wants people to be able to watch their films and share their films and talk about their films. And so, you know, it's there are a lot of places that are buying it. It's still like you want to go, you know, Netflix is an extraordinary place to have your film. Hulu is an amazing place to have your film. You know, getting your film featured in the iTunes store is really exciting for filmmakers still. So those are always kind of, I think, the top of the list for people.
Right. So in terms of apples and oranges, that is sort of akin to filmmakers that make deals that may not be as financially advantageous up front, but they definitely want to see their film in the theater. So they'll make different deals just because the emotional factor of getting your movie up on the big screen has a lot of weight in the deal-making process. So I would imagine for a documentarian, Netflix and Hulu would be similar to that, because you know how many eyeballs could possibly be on it.
Yeah. I mean, I just think kind of the moment that is baffling, I'm so excited about, is when you turn on Netflix and you see the Tiger King square next to Extraction, and the squares are the same size and they're on the same trending category. Like, that just never happened before, right? Like, if you're a filmmaker, you cannot get your films to be the same as Extraction, which is going to play in 3,000 theaters or whatever. And on Netflix or on streaming, they look the same. That is radical, right? So films look the same, even though Tiger King has many episodes. You could imagine a short doc could also be right up there too. Like, it's just all of those things are kind of breaking. But to be able to have your film on that sort of platform, I think, is really the dream. Now, I think there's a way, you know, COVID has sort of disrupted everything. I still think there's a way to do better theatrically for documentaries. I don't know the answer to it, but I'd like to try to figure that out and to be a part of it. And we're kind of working on a lot of different things. So hopefully when theaters come back, I think there's a lot of growth that documentaries can have theatrically. And I mean, I'll give examples. Like, when you think about Apollo 11, it's the same movie as First Man, right? But it's like Apollo 11 is, you know, I would argue is a better, more exciting film than First Man. Or, you know, RBG comes out, and then they make the narrative remake of Her Story right after, or Won't You Be My Neighbor comes out, and then Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Like, you're finding these films that are documentaries and then remade as these big budget, crazy films. I think there's a question to be had, which is like, do you need Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood if you have Won't You Be My Neighbor, if you can just figure out how to get Won't You Be My Neighbor in front of as many people as Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, right? Like,
right.
That's where I feel like there's a lot of very interesting space. And, you know this area so well. It's like, how do you really start to blend those lines between a documentary? And I think I'd argue Firefest is this, like, a documentary is as big or as exciting as any action movie. Like, isn't Free Solo as good as a Spider-Man movie? I don't know. That's where I feel like, just how do you break that through, where you just make Free Solo an action movie, not a documentary?
Well, I would say that those three examples would not make as compelling of scripted series. I don't think the Last Dance would. I just think watching Michael Jordan be Michael Jordan is an extraordinary thing, and it just brings back so many painful memories for me as being a Lakers fan. And then Firefest, I just think, you know, you really want Jonah Hill just to recreate what that guy did so brilliantly as himself. You know, and I think that again, Free Solo too. It's just just Tobey Maguire playing that guy doing that with special effects is never going to be as interesting as just watching it. And I agree with you. I think that they're the same measure of determining whether or not something's quote unquote theatrical will probably go into the documentaries, whereas Free Solo was so unbelievably insane to watch on the big screen. It was just earth-shatteringly scary for somebody who's afraid of heights, such as myself. And I think that, you know, Apollo 11, those kind of movies that have scope are going to be definitely right up there with everything else in terms of the way people are now consuming content. That will be the next piece of it, of, you know, seeing Free Solo on IMAX in the same way you would see Spider-Man in IMAX. And then again, I think that the Fyre festivals, which are a little bit more of the comedies, will still play really well for streaming. And I think the Tiger King falls into that, where I agree with you that the tenderness of which the Tiger King was made, and letting the absurdity and the comedy and the drama play naturally rather than forcing it with a host that's trying to reach for the joke. And it's interesting because it never really works. Like, all the after shows never really work. I mean, they're always just like, you're just sort of wrapping up loose ends. Even Deadliest Catch, like, just seeing those guys sit around the table, talk about shit you've already seen and watch footage is just not remotely as compelling as watching these guys risk their lives to fish in the North Atlantic. And so it's fascinating to me that they took something so huge, and because of the timing of it, that they just decided to just kind of plop something out there that was just sort of, I felt like, undermined the whole experience for me.
Yeah. I did too. But I think that one of the things that we study a lot at XTR now, and, you know, it's kind of like, what films were popular post Second World War? You know, like, what are the films that people are going to start talking about and thinking about and wanting to watch now? And I mean, as we're in production on documentaries, we're really trying to figure out how do we tell stories? How are all of our films that we're making right now not about COVID or about the lockdown? Right. It's like, it's really this kind of amazing moment where you're having to rethink the stories and the films that you're making. And then also we're spending a lot of time trying to see what came before it. Right. And like, if you look at post-war cinema, it's like, it's nostalgia, it's escapism. Right. And then you look at The Last Dance and it's nostalgia, and like Tiger King is escapism. Like, the roadmap has been written for what people want to watch right now. That's a big focus of kind of what we're looking for. So you talk about what subjects we look out for. I mean, we're looking for things that fill into what people historically have wanted to see after a disaster.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about the disaster, because it leads into the next piece of this, which is, how are you adjusting? Because we talked about Sundance and we talked about Tribeca and we talked about South by Southwest as being great places to sell big titles. And those things are shut down for the time being, especially for you guys. South by Southwest, you had your documentary, You Can't Kill David Arquette, that was supposed to play there, which would have crushed because it's a raucous crowd. I mean, it is literally, it's the, when I was co-president of Disney and was had that job at Revolution, I would never let executives buy anything at Sundance, because you go there and you'd be drinking all day, skiing, you're at altitude, you'd see a midnight screening of something and think it was the greatest thing you've ever seen in your life because the crowd was so insane. You'd spend way too much money on it, and then it would come out in the real world, be like, what the fuck were people thinking? Why did they pay so much money for that? So I can imagine the excitement you must have had of seeing this thing play at South by Southwest, and then that being being those hopes being dashed because they canceled it. And then you did this a great pivot to premiere at David's house. But beyond just pivoting with somebody like David Arquette, who's also an investor in your company and is a big celebrity and has a wide social media following and kind of can get that out there, how are you pivoting now, given that there might not be real film festivals for the time being?
South By was a real gut punch because, our film You Cannot Kill David Arquette is about David Arquette's kind of brief stint as a wrestler, and then he wants to return to professional wrestling to get his name back. And David and I met in Haiti, where I used to work with his sister, Patricia Arquette, after the earthquake. And he came to me and said, I really want to tell this story. And we put together this film and have been making it for the last 3 years. He almost dies in the ring. I mean, he loses 50 pounds. It's this like total stand up and cheer, escapist, beautiful film. And there was one festival that we wanted to get it to have the world premiere, and that was South By. From like the moment I had the first conversation, I think this far in advance, like when I first sit with a subject and I'm like, yeah, we should make that film. I'm literally thinking, okay, when do we need to finish the edit so it can get into Sundance or South By or Tribeca? Like I'm planning that far in advance. Maybe that's admitting too much, but I'm thinking that far in advance. And so South By was like the place that we wanted it to be when it got in. Janet Pearson, who's so extraordinary, loved the film and was so excited. We had a huge party planned with luchadors and wrestlers, and we took over this bar in Austin. It was canceled. And it was a time that was so heartbreaking, but also not a time you can feel sorry for yourself, because, like, man, it was heartbreaking for Austin and all the other filmmakers and the industry. I mean, it was like everybody got really beat up on that one. I think we found a home for it, which we'll be announcing soon, which is couldn't be more excited about. So, I will just say that the industry is moving. I'm hoping that when we make the announcement, we're the first film that is sold out of South By. And I'm hoping that that's a very powerful story to the industry, where people go, yes, like we had a setback, but the industry is buying films, which is exciting. We had two films at Tribeca, and Tribeca got canceled. I mean, it's a tough moment. And it's a moment where everybody's got to pivot and go, how do we get this film in front of the right people?
So is it just a matter now of you emailing your 30 friends and saying, okay, here's this movie that was supposed to be at Tribeca, take a look, let's discuss after? Is that how you're doing it? Or are you setting up pitches through Zoom? By the way, if you ever do the David Arquette screening with the Lucha Libre and all that, I have to be invited. I have to see that.
I promise you we are going to do it, and I promise you will be invited.
I have to come.
Like I said before, I'm a deep optimist about this moment. So I think we're out of this, sooner than we fear, and we're going to be back to being able to get together and watch films and celebrate. But
is that how you pivoted? Just, are you now just sending links? Are you, how are you selling things when there aren't these festivals that are live right now?
I think it's still a combination. I mean, we work with different sales agents who have different relationships, but I would say that it is relationships are the most important thing. We have a Google Doc at XTR that is a living document of every single buyer, the executive there, and what their taste and what they're looking for is. And we update it constantly as executives change or as mandates change. And so I think we have a good understanding of what the industry is looking for, and we kind of know the targets. And when we're working with sales agents, it's the same way. Some of it is virtual screenings. I've never been one for like forcing people to watch it in a certain place at a certain time. I love the film festival experience, but outside of that, I think sending people links where they can watch it on their own time in their own space is really important. Some people don't like doing that. I don't know what your experience is, but people want to do it in a special, the link expires at this time and you have to watch it in this room. I want people to be able to relax and see it where they want to see it. And you also have to then trust that they're going to turn their phone off and kind of try to give it the time that it deserves.
Well, that that's a bigger conversation also just about distribution as a whole, because you're revealing how you feel about distribution as a whole, because I agree with you. I'm all for people being able to see things when they want to, how they want to, and being able to charge accordingly. You know, and nobody's is probably a bigger optimist than me, because I'm a 50-year-old independent film producer. Yeah. If I'm not optimistic, I'm in big trouble. I agree with you. And I, you know, I've come to the realization as I've been talking to everybody during this time that we are, in fact, you know, if this thing goes on for another month, we are, in fact, blowing through all the content that everybody said there was no way we were ever going to be able to consume. I mean, obviously, everybody's not consuming every piece of content, but I think everybody will probably consume the content way deeper level than they ever thought they would in their lifetime, and finding new things that they never thought they would have had the time to enjoy. And I agree with you. I'm very optimistic coming out of this that the thing that we're going to need most is content, because there will be a lull where everybody goes back to their regular lives and does the things they have been prevented from doing with the stay-at-home order. But it's not going away. People have discovered that there's a lot of great stuff out there, and they're going to be willing to try new flavors that they weren't, you know, normally trying when they were doing their workaday lives. And that's going to give a lot of opportunity for new voices, different kinds of formats. You know, again, your field opening wide up in terms of all different formats. Quibi now, Jeffrey's in this space of, you know, just saying, hey, there's a whole different way to watch content. It's in smaller bites. So there's so many different ways for content creators right now to shine. And I'm so excited for your industry. And I'm, you know, in the process of trying to get into it right now with an old friend. We have secured the rights to this pretty cool thing. And I've found, interestingly enough, it's identical to my business, because we're in a rights chase right now with another producer. Exactly. Great. And it's like, oh, I know this feeling. I know exactly what this is. This is exactly the same. So I'm just excited, because there's so many different ways to create right now. Even for me, such an old timer who's been doing it so long, just the excitement of being able to create new and different things in different formats and different lengths and different, you know, series breaks and things like that. It's really an exciting time to be a creator.
Oh, I love your optimism. I feel the same way. I mean, it's kind of like that moment in Forrest Gump where they go out to sea and there's a bad storm and they come back in and they're catching all the shrimp. You know, like, if we can weather this, and if people have the kind of strength and make the right decisions and understand how to get through this moment, it's pretty incredible. The industry that we can build on the other side of it. I really believe that. And it can, you know, it will look different. If we do it right, it looks different. It looks more diverse. There's new voices, there's new filmmakers, there's new executives, new power, new platforms. And so I just think there is, we sit at a precipice of an extraordinary, you know, an extraordinarily difficult, terrible time, which will be very hard to get through. But on the other side, the show must go on.
Absolutely.
And that's what we do.
So what are you doing currently in this crisis? What is your routine like right now?
Yeah. Every morning I have an all staff with my team that we do on Zoom. Everybody jumps on, you know, this call for an hour where we kind of do an update, go around the room, see where everybody's at. I, you know, the rest of the time I'm set up in my living room. I have a 3-month-old baby, so I'm taking many breaks to play with him. You know, just rolling calls, pushing through. We're closing a lot of really big deals. We're soon to be announcing some massive documentaries. I mean, like, the work has not slowed down. I will say, back to documentaries, like, documentaries are going to be the first things up in true production. They're going to beat indie films, right? Like, or regular TV, like docs. We're shooting some docs with some big celebrities, and we're figuring out now a combination of masks and social distance and antibody tests, how we're going to be shooting in June, with small crews. And that's an easier decision to ramp production up for a documentary with 3-person crew than a big film with a 100-person crew or a TV show. So we feel lucky that our industry is still going. So many of our docs are in post. I would say that we've completely looked at our upcoming slate, and we've pivoted off of production heavy docs to post-production. So we've really looked at the slate and gone, okay, anything that's in the can, that's going to be our focus. Anything that still has to be shot, we have to just take a beat on that if it's going to be a big, you know, international shoot or something. So, you know, look, we're figuring it out. I still slip out to see my business partner, and we stand across the street from each other and catch up because that's really helpful. And our daily meetings with the team is half business and half therapy. It's just kind of like, you know, look, this is a very hard time to be alone. And a lot of the people on my team are young, you know, filmmakers, passionate documentary people who live alone in an apartment. And that's a hard time. And so as the leader of a company, you've got to figure out how, you know, to take care of your team. And right now, a lot of that is in, from an emotional standpoint of just like, hey, look, we're going to get through this. And, you know, I visit people and wave out of the window and try to do the best in this moment. But I mean, overall, our work has never been busier. And, you know, we're lucky enough as a company to be relatively small, where we're able to weather out the storm. And I raised enough money to kind of keep going through it. And, you know, I'm fortunate enough that we're not a massive production company that had to do a lot of layoffs. I think that we're nimble enough to kind of get through this moment.
And what are you doing on a daily basis to keep those creative juices flowing and to keep kind of your eye, not just on the work prize, but on the storytelling prize and just the, you know, the thing that's keeping you excited about being a filmmaker?
Yeah. I mean, look, the thing that's most exciting is, like we talked about, the most watched, talked about piece of content are nonfiction, our documentary right now. And I would argue that even before this, the most talked about pieces of content are documentary, like R. Kelly, Michael Jackson, Firefest, The Daily. People are talking about podcasts like it's Making a Murderer, The Keeper. Like, those are the things that people talk about the next day at work, not whatever happened on CSI Miami or so. It's like those are irrelevant. And so I think that the thing that is inspiring me during this time is that people are discovering documentary for the first time in many cases and loving it. So that's a great sign. And then I'm also inspired by my documentary community that is like rallying around each other, helping each other, figuring out how to keep shooting, how to keep working. And I'm also proud of my city of Los Angeles, you know, which is just like has shown up to be a beautiful city of angels. So I'm filled with a lot of hope and optimism and pride in this moment, because if you're not those things during this time, you're not going to get out of bed. So it's like, it's also a survival tactic, which is just like, you know, how do we try to do the best we can in this moment, take care of our community, our friends, and try to get out the other side, because that's a really exciting place to be.
So what has been the best thing you've seen in these last 6 weeks of stay at home order? What has inspired you that you've seen in this COVID crisis?
Look, I think I'm inspired by people trying to figure out how to make content during this time. I've got a lot of friends at SNL. Watching them experiment and try to make that work is pretty thrilling to watch, right? Katy Perry's a good friend of mine, watching her do American Idol, or people try to bring back late shows. Like, I think that spirit of, let's figure it out is really cool, especially for like an old film school person like me, who's, you know, that's the spirit of everything. Like, how do we make a movie, with, you know, this crappy VHS camera? Like, it's like that spirit of ingenuity, is happening. And I have friends who, are incredible actors who are starting to like shoot little films and get together with their friends and make little, like, how do we do a social distance quarantine movie? Like, I love that. And I have always wished that in LA there was more of that. Like, you have this amazing creative community that I think doesn't experiment enough. Right. Like, everybody left film school or whatever and came out here and got serious and is just trying to get on Game of Thrones or whatever. But like, people stopped making films on the weekend and at night, with their buddies. And like, that's happening again. that's awesome.
So what advice would you have for the person right now sitting in quarantine, listening to you talk about this great business and how it's going to explode and where it's headed? What's your advice for that person who is sitting there going, I have a laptop and I have a phone and I have a, yes, and I have the storytelling instinct. What's your advice to get started?
Yeah. I mean, it's the same advice that everybody's been doing forever, which is just like shoot and tell your stories. I mean, figure out how to make a documentary on your TikTok, figure out how to publish docs, little docs on Instagram, you know, shoot your day, start learning how to edit. I mean, it's just, we have all the tools. Like your phone has a full edit app on it, like Final Cut, like you've got iMovie, you've got a camera that's 4K. Like it's just an extraordinary moment. And there's no excuse, you know, like everybody's stuck inside. What better moment than to start learning how to become a filmmaker and then make something and do what I did, which is submit it to a film festival. And like, if you get in, you're a filmmaker. You started, no turning back. And if you don't get in, go make a better one until you do.
I love that, man. Well, thank you. Thank you so much. This has been really, really inspiring and insightful. And I'm thrilled for you and I'm thrilled for your studio. And I can't wait to see all the great content that's going to come out of it. Really. Thank you so much for sitting down and doing this with me.
We'll see you in the wrestling ring. I appreciate it.
I love it. All right, friend. Thank you, brother.
Bye-bye.